Tuesday, September 20th, was one of those extravagantly full days that began at 7:30 with coffee and dressing, and then Jean-Louis for a shampoo and set, and then Mrs. Provenson to practice with me on my speeches for about an hour and a half. And then over to Lyndon's office for a last goodbye and pictures, and on to the National Airport for as remarkable a flight as any American Airlines jet ever had, including some 63 passengers, press, photographers, Cyril Magnin, fashion models, 40 different outfits for them to wear, Secret Service staff and me, and my seedling from the White House lawn. All we lacked was a beagle. I sat with Cyril Magnin, Lyndon's good supporter, Adele Simpson's brother-in-law, and very successful businessman, and heard how he'd expanded his father's one store into an extensive chain of many units, all catering to the bright young woman. It had been gray and raining in Washington, but 15 minutes out, we were in clear, bright sky, and then the fashion show began, together with cocktails for everybody. Absolutely unique of its kind, with the girls changing in a space the size of a telephone booth, and the clothes pure California, ranging from vinyl sheaths and miniskirts and earrings as big as golf balls and pantsuits and metallic gold stockings to a few well-tailored gray suits and a smashing red, white, and blue outfit by Bill Blass that I would have liked to have had, and evening clothes, one called the Yellow Rose of Texas. Later, I read where one of the news writers, in describing All Aboard, had said, and Mrs. Johnson's own impressive wardrobe. Well, that's another first. There was lots for Linda Bird and Lucy to love, but not for me. We had an extravagantly elegant lunch. Many hors d'oeuvres and then a shrimp bisque, salmon souffle, and your choice of filet mignon or lobster Newburgh, and then a pineapple mousse Sierra with champagne. Since it was a 5.5-hour flight and a very long time till any dinner, I ate self-indulgently and then happily slipped inside a little curtained-off area where about 2 seats had been turned into a bed for me. Read my speech cards and dozed. It was some 3,000 miles later and already evening, 7 o'clock my time, when I arrived at Hamilton Air Force Base. But it was only 4 o'clock California time and just the beginning of our work day. It was unbelievably beautiful weather. And there was Governor Brown and Bernice at the foot of the plane and a small crowd of some 500 people. The governor welcomed me and I made a few remarks, explaining while I was there. Delighted to see some of the proudest possessions of this state, your magnificent seashore, your great opera, your scenic highway. Praise of Governor Brown and what he has done for beautification, conservation, in calling his own state conference, in the $150 million bond issue for parks, in the statewide competition for excellence in design. So many things label California as a front runner in the natural beauty movement, and much of it is a result of the foresight and leadership of its governor. And then we were off in a helicopter to Point Reyes, with Governor Brown and Bernice by me, explaining the history of the region, and Stu Udall explaining how it came to be a national seashore. Only 15 minutes from San Francisco, it was a world away in mood and vista. The great roaring surf, dramatic white cliffs with a narrow spread of beach, and inland a rural scene of waving grasses and here and there a dairy farm. Sir Francis Drake, in his pursuit of Spanish galleons, is supposed to have landed on this beach to repair his ship. Point Reyes is called the land that time forgot. It is a good name. There was a small crowd. One enthusiastic newspaper estimated it at 6,000, but I think it was probably closer to 1,000, which another paper carried. Many school children, some whose badges indicated they were members of a conservation group, the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, and others whose welcoming banners were a rather bizarre note, proclaiming them members of the local unions, carpenters, plumbers, butchers, and so forth. We walked up on an improvised platform, the Browns, George Hartzog, the Udalls, and I, with our backs to the Pacific and our faces to the people standing in the sand. And there was a brief ceremony, the most dramatic part of which, by all odds, was the rhythmic roar of the surf as it crashed in behind us, accenting every few sentences. I rather liked my speech. I talked about what a national seashore could mean as a place of peace in the lives of our people, For one of the dominant facts of modern times is that Americans, who traditionally have been close to the land, now live and work farther and farther from natural surroundings. Every person wants a sense of place, and a place where he can be at repose. For many, many Americans, that place of refreshment will be land owned by all the people, parks, seashores, refuges of one kind or another. The growing needs of an urban America are quickening the tick of the conservation clock. I used the legend of Antaeus and some quotes from Thoreau and probably got rather far afield for my audience who were digging their toes in the sand. And then I unveiled a dedicatory plaque naming this a national seashore. The outlines of a Park Service building were already going up. Tall timbers painted sea green, planted in the sand, sticking skyward. And then, for the benefit of the photographers, we strolled on the beach, Governor Brown and Stu and I, and a great wave came crashing in right behind us, and we did a beach ballet, advancing before it. I shook hands through the crowd, all quite happy and genial. None of the ugly banners yet that I had been led to believe would appear at every California stop. And then we were off in the helicopter, flying back over San Francisco, and a marvelous view of the Golden Gate Bridge, which we circled, and into Cressy Field. Brief greetings from the top officers of the field, and then in a motorcade to the Fairmont Hotel, through friendly signs of welcome in a crowded lobby, with the Browns up to our suite, where there was the most breathtaking view of the harbor and ships moving in, and that beautiful city spread out below us. And then there was 30 minutes of rest. Inevitably, it gets shortened. If it began as 2 hours, it dwindles. A roast beef sandwich in bed. Time to look at the cards from the many flowers, the wine, the fruit. And then into my flowered brocade sheath, covered with floating layers of pale green chiffon by George Stavropoulos. A hairdresser in to pile my hair up on top of my head. And what I hoped would do justice to the elegant evening before me. A little past 8, Governor Brown and Bernice and Roger Stevens and the Udalls came by for me, and we left for the opera. On the way, I couldn't help hearing chatter over communications about pickets outside the opera house. And when we rolled up to the entrance, there they were, chanting loudly. I was aware of their presence. I did not look their way. There was an aura of madness, a sort of mob spirit. Later, I read that some of them carried babies, and some carried guitars, and most of them carried signs that said, "Ladybird, bring our troops home now," or "Ladybird, beautify Vietnam." They were there for the television cameras, and they got some of them, but as little as we could manage. I walked in with whatever dignity and decorum I could manage, smiling and speaking to right and left, and declining to be hurried, to the extent that I could direct the situation. And then we were inside and greeted by our hostess, Mrs. Robert Watt Miller, and a little later by her husband, tall, graying, gallant Mr. Miller, who's president of the Opera Association and has been for 29 years. The Browns sat in the box with us, and Roger Stevens, my escort, and our co-host with the director of the opera, and Mrs. Kurt Adler, and a couple of longtime Washingtonians, the John McCones were there. He's former head of CIA. The Charles DeYoung Theriots, the publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle, who had been at the White House for the Tchaikovsky Award Winners Party. Governor Brown told me on the way that the McCones had already come out for Reagan, and the Millers were, he believed, longtime Republicans. But that in no way affected the warmth, the pleasure of the evening. And the Millers I found especially delightful. It was very different from the New York opening. Comparisons I dislike, but this one was inevitable. The opera house was old-fashioned and elegant, much smaller than the Metropolitan, almost cozy. And there were great bouquets of flowers on the railings of the boxes and the grand tier and balcony. And the opera itself was pure melody, Bellini's E Puritani. I never heard of it. It was rather like Verdi. Aria after aria, liquid, lovely, fluid melody. We could practically ignore the most unpromising story. It was about Puritans and Cromwell and their conflict with King Charles of England. I've never thought Puritans were flashy enough to be the subject of an opera. And Joan Sutherland, whose voice was so beautiful, she's called the world's greatest coloratura soprano. It's an exquisite instrument. It was grand opera in the grand tradition, and I loved every minute of it. The audience, I thought, came to hear the music rather than to look at each other, although there were plenty of piled-up hairdos, 2 and 3 half pieces, I expect. Hairdressers rushing around madly all day long. One said he'd done his first makeup at 9:30 that morning. Somewhere during the performance, Jerry was bending over my shoulder, saying, in a very imperious voice, "Will you please come with me right away, you and Governor and Mrs. Brown?" I looked at him quickly, leaned over and said to my hostess, Mrs. Miller, "Will you please excuse us for a few minutes?" Murmured to Mrs. Brown, asking her to come with me and bring the Governor. And the three of us walked out, strolled calmly through the lobby, and into a neighboring box, turned out to be the grandson of our host. It was the box where Tyler Abel was a guest. It was all very quiet. We stayed for about 20 minutes, and then returned to the Miller's box. Later, I saw a simple notice in the paper that we had paid a visit to another box during the second act. So I guess we won on this one. At least we weren't conspicuous. Maybe they thought that a game of musical chairs is just a part of what they're supposed to do. Later on, back at the hotel, Jerry told me that he'd gotten a message from the FBI that a bomb had been planted and was supposed to go off in our portion of the opera house at 9:30. He had about 10 minutes to decide what to do with us. To take us back outdoors would only create confusion and alarm. He quickly located Tyler's box and took us over there to the other side of the building. And he felt sure, he said, that the call had come from some of the pickets outside who had hoped that we would emerge in fear and haste and have some wild picture taken. I enjoyed sitting by Mrs. Miller. She described their years of working with the opera. The whole audience seemed to regard it as their opera. I loved the feeling of the evening. During the second intermission, the Millers gave a small champagne party. We shook hands with quite a few guests, and at one time we went outside for pictures. And then, when it was over, close to 12 o'clock, we went backstage. The gentleman escorted me, murmured, "This is your debut in the opera." And there it was, all ropes and scenery and lights, and one had to pick one's way across obstacles. We met some of the cast, the Spanish tenor Alfredo Kraus, who had played Joan Sutherland's lover, not too strong, I thought, the really great villain named Molansky, and her father, who had been perhaps the best of all, and then Joan Sutherland. Exhausted after her mad scenes and her magnificent, very demanding performance. I had already sent flowers and notes to the 4 leading people. I framed my delight in the best words I could. They gave me a scroll for the president, commending him on his support for the arts. And then I went out with Roger Stevens and the U-Dolls and Mrs. Brown. The governor had already left, poor man, to fly to a bar convention to deliver a speech at dawn the next morning. And we were back at our suite a little past 12, only it was about 3 o'clock Washington time. Excited, exhilarated, weary. But there was not a minute of the day I would have done without.